You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In a moment, we will have an infectious disease physician on the rise of the Delta variant in Wisconsin. What do you want to know about how to avoid breakthrough infections? What are your questions on new masking recommendations? Join in now, 800-642-1234. But first, communities across Wisconsin continue to find PFAS, often called forever chemicals, in their drinking water. But once the contamination is discovered, finding a fix or an alternative water source for residents, not easy. Hope Kerwin has more from French Island, one of the latest communities in Wisconsin to discover PFAS in their water.
French Island sits between the Mississippi and Black Rivers. It's home to part of the city of La Crosse and the town of Campbell. And it's where Dale and Mary Wetterling decided to build their home 30 years ago.
It was my husband's dream house. So it'll be a sad day when we have to move out of this house.
But the two retired school teachers have a new housemate, Aqua Maria. That's the name Mary gave their Culligan water dispenser when it arrived last fall after the couple found out their private well was contaminated with PFAS.
It had to have a name, right? I mean, like, you bring a child into the world, you give them a name. Some people name their boats.
PFAS, often called forever chemicals, are a group of man-made substances that don't break down and have been linked to adverse health effects like increased cholesterol, cancer, and thyroid disease. In 2019, the State Department of Natural Resources ordered the city of La Crosse to investigate PFAS in city-owned wells on French Island that officials believe came from firefighting foam used at and around the La Crosse Regional Airport. The city, state, and residents eventually tested more than 500 of the island's private wells. Only 12 did not have some level of PFAS. More than a quarter exceeded the state's recommended standard for drinking water. The DNR declared an emergency water advisory for the island in March. Now the city and state are providing residents those 5-gallon water jugs. But Mary Wetterling says the jugs are an imperfect solution for her and her older neighbors.
We have two women on our street who are widows, and they literally cannot pick up that big, huge gallon.
Finding a permanent source of clean water for Campbell residents is already proving elusive. Campbell Town Chair Josh Johnson says the municipality doesn't have the money to build its own water system. Treating the island's nearly 1,500 private wells would be costly, and digging them deeper could spread the contamination. But Johnson says many residents prefer the independence and lower property taxes that come with their private wells.
They don't want anything from anybody else, and they want to do it their own way. A lot of them want to keep their own wells and put in their own treatment systems. A lot of them already have.
The DNR has recommended that communities like Campbell tap into municipal water systems like the city of La Crosse when available. But town residents are skeptical, and city officials aren't rushing to offer water anyway. In an interview with WPR's Newsmakers, Mayor Mitch Reynolds said evaluating the best path forward will take time.
We can't jump into solutions that may be ineffective, and we're not at the point where we are providing remediation or mitigation.
More than 900 Campbell residents are planning to take legal action against La Crosse over the contamination and for failing to notify them when the chemicals were first discovered in city water in 2014. La Crosse filed its own lawsuit in March, claiming the chemical companies that make PFAS knew about the chemicals' risks for decades and continue to use them. But winning one of these legal battles doesn't guarantee an easy path to a solution. Earlier this year, residents in the town of Peshtigo in northern Wisconsin reached a $17.5 million settlement with a chemical company over PFAS. But residents are still waiting for a permanent source of safe water. That scares Campbelltown Supervisor Lee Donahue.
3.5 years from now, we do not want to be drinking bottled water. We want to be drinking a safe alternative water source.
It's the same fear that pushed Dale and Mary Wetterling to pay $3,000 to have a water filtration system put into their home earlier this year.
You had to do something because we don't know how long we're going to be here, and I'm sure we're going to move out of here before that's resolved.
Dale worries about his neighbors who can't afford that kind of expense. He says they're all anxious about how the contamination will impact their property values and how their health may have already been affected. It may be years before they have answers to those questions and more. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And tomorrow we'll hear about the town of Peshtigo, where residents have been relying on bottled water for years. And then we'll hear from WPR reporters covering this environmental problem. That's right here tomorrow after 7. And now to the spread of the Delta variant. How should vaccinated people adjust their lives and behaviors in this surge? According to the CDC's COVID tracker, 10 counties in Wisconsin are experiencing high transmission, including a cluster in the southeastern part of our state. What do you want to know about masking, about gathering with family and friends, about what hospitals are seeing? 800-642-1234. Allison Schwartz is Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health's Wisconsin region. She treats patients in Madison and Janesville. Dr. Schwartz, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. You know, the headlines we're seeing about breakthrough infections and new precautions for fully vaccinated people, it's causing confusion. It's worrisome. Can you start by explaining the CDC's new masking recommendations?
Sure. I think what we found out about the Delta variant is that more so than some of the prior variants we've been following, this one does seem to be spreading very readily and can cause very high viral loads in patients. And there was a study last week that was released in the MMWR, which is one of the reports from the CDC, that looked at a high number of cases that resulted in patients who were fully vaccinated. And those patients were found to have very high RNA levels when they actually looked at the studies. And so it kind of brings us back to the evolution of science and sort of looking at things that, going back to the basics for the pandemic, this is a variant that, because it is spreading so aggressively, even in patients who are vaccinated, we go back to the recommendations of masking and social distancing to help prevent the spread and protect patients who are vaccinated. It's important to recognize that no vaccine is 100% effective. And what we are seeing with the benefits of vaccine is that patients who do become infected are still much less likely to become severely ill, hospitalized, or die. And so this in no means is meant to worry people or make them think that the vaccine is not doing what it's supposed to, but just, again, going back to the basics of adding that other layer of protection to help prevent the spread and also, you know, protect vulnerable patients who may have waning immunity now from the vaccine or may not be able to get vaccinated because of some other medical reason.
So where does that leave us with masking? When should we be wearing masks?
So really, it's important that anyone who may have a weakened immune system or have, you know, other vulnerable family members in the home or even young children who cannot get vaccinated, that those people do mask in settings where you're going to be indoors, you know, in a large crowd with other people, around other people who may be unvaccinated. Those are going to be situations where definitely, at least if you're immune compromised, you want to be masked, and like I said, people who are around others who may not be vaccinated or may be vulnerable. But then again, for the general population, because now we're seeing so much spread of the virus and these higher rates, as we talk about, you know, even what's going on in Wisconsin and the high rates of transmission that we're seeing here, in some of those situations, even if you're not immune compromised and even if you are vaccinated, the recommendation would be that, you know, in an indoor crowded setting around other people who you may not know their vaccine status, and, you know, really just even outdoors, if you're going to be around a lot of other people, it may still benefit you to wear a mask.
What are you seeing in the hospital? What changes are you seeing with the Delta variant?
Sure. I would say majority of the hospitalized patients we are seeing are those who are unvaccinated. And so, you know, nationwide, when we look at the trends, they talk a lot about even younger patients who are ending up hospitalized, ending up in the ICU. And again, a vast majority of those patients are unvaccinated. So for anyone who, you know, still has questions about the vaccine or thinks that, oh, if I have to go back to masking, then the vaccine doesn't work, that's certainly not the case. You know, in fact, it's quite the opposite, that because we're seeing so much spread of this variant, now more than ever, it's important to emphasize the importance of vaccination and how that can protect you and your loved ones and actually keep you out of the hospital and reduce your risk for severe disease or death.
Is there any way for a person to know if they have the Delta variant if they're diagnosed with COVID?
To be honest with you, when we do the sequencing data, most of that does not come back to an individual. And so not necessarily. However, what I would say, at least looking at the Wisconsin data, more than 80 90%+, this is as of last week, was felt to be the Delta variant. So it's sort of the assumption at this point, if you were to become ill with SARS-CoV-2, that it most likely is the Delta variant. And not only in Wisconsin, but again, those are the trends we're seeing nationwide. 80 to 90% of the virus that is being sequenced is this Delta variant.
Allison Schwartz is an infectious disease specialist with SSM Health Dean Medical Group. She's fielding your questions on the Delta variant and what her hospital is experiencing in this surge. What do you want to ask the doctor about traveling or eating in restaurants? Are you worried, again, about hugging and visiting older relatives? What about unvaccinated kids? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Schwartz here on the Ideas Network. We're getting your questions answered about COVID vaccines, about masking, the Delta variant here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The rise of the Delta variant has raised new questions about how vaccinated people can stay safe and avoid breakthrough infections. We have an infectious disease physician fielding your questions as new COVID cases continue on an upward trend in Wisconsin. The CDC now estimates that Delta accounts for 82% of cases in our country. How do you know if you have the variant? What do you want to know about masking or upgrading your mask? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Allison Schwartz is an infectious disease specialist, stays with us. Dr. Schwartz, the CDC says the Delta variant is as transmissible as chickenpox. Can you help put us in perspective? How contagious is it?
Sure. So, you know, in the past, we've talked a lot about the difference between droplet transmission and airborne transmission. So when we think about viruses and kind of how they spread from person to person, if you think about a big sort of droplet, that's something that's heavy, it's going to fall to the ground very quickly, you're not going to be able to infect as many people. Airborne transmission refers more to those little tiny droplets that can hang around in the air and therefore infect more people. And so when we think about the new Delta variant, I'm sort of bringing this up again just as an analogy for patients to think about or people to think about that, you know, they talk about the R naught being 6, which means that really if there's one person who might be coughing in a room, there are these tiny micro droplets that can stick around and infect several other people, which is, you know, a much higher number than we were dealing with before.
What might a breakthrough infection look like, or what does a mild breakthrough infection, how might that appear?
Sure. I mean, I think it's important for everyone to remember that, you know, one of the big tools that we have with the pandemic is testing. And so if you're experiencing any symptoms, so the traditional, as we talked about previously in the pandemic, fevers, sore throat, there can be some mild cough, headaches, fatigue, all of these things would be, you know, key indicators to go get tested again so that you yourself can have a diagnosis and then know if you need to appropriately isolate and have other members who may have been exposed to quarantine as not to spread infection to others. It seems like compared to the earlier variants, one of the symptoms that we're seeing less with the Delta variant is that loss of taste and smell. But that was another kind of classic symptom of COVID infection that people talked about earlier in the pandemic. Again, could be a reason to go get tested.
Let's bring in Tony in Bay Harbor. Hi, Tony. What would you like to ask the doctor?
Good morning. I've heard reports that anybody who is not vaccinated will contract the Delta variant. It's inevitable. We went from 35,000 cases a day to 100,000 cases a day in about 3 days. If that is true, then how long will it take before all the non-vaccinated contract the variant and then it just works through the system and then we're done with the Delta, but then we don't know if there's going to be another variant after that?
Yeah, Tony, thank you. The ebb and flow of Delta, Dr. Schwartz.
Yeah, that's a great point that Tony brings up. I mean, you know, that's been some people's theory all along. If we just let kind of this wildfire burn through, then will we reach this quote unquote herd immunity and everything will be fine. But Tony brings up a great point that I think first of all, because this virus is so much more infectious than some of the previous variants that we've seen, the level of infectivity that we would have to reach to get to herd immunity is much higher, because you have to assume it's spreading more and more from person to person, and so all the excess deaths, et cetera, that would occur. And then again, allowing the virus to continue to circulate and infect people, that's how we're ending up in these variant situations. And so truly, it's not going to benefit us just to let everyone get sick and go that route. And again, we go back to, fortunately, we're much better off in regards to the personal protective equipment we need in the hospital. And in the United States, we're very fortunate that in most areas right now, ICU beds are not an issue. But those are things that we start to worry about as more and more people become ill and infected, is how will this impact our healthcare system? And then kind of trickling down the line, all the post-infectious sequelae of the virus. We talk about long COVID and other, effects of the virus long-term, increasing risk for heart attack and stroke. I think that was something that came out yesterday. I mean, these are all reasons that really our best protection is going to be vaccination rather than just letting everyone get sick and kind of letting it run its course.
We've seen so many healthcare systems and private companies, corporations making the vaccine a mandate, making their employees get the vaccine. What is SSM Health doing on this front?
Yes, we have actually, as of a few weeks ago, put out recommendations that we are going to require all SSM Health employees to get vaccinated. And so we're working through that process now. There's deadlines and then, of course, medical exemptions for those patients who cannot get vaccinated, et cetera. And really trying to ease the concern still of employees or anyone else who may still have some hesitation about vaccination, and really kind of talking about now is the time, not only because it's mandated, but because of what we're seeing in the community and kind of what's going on with the spread of this Delta variant.
We have Dr. Allison Schwartz of SSM Health with us, part of the infectious disease team, fielding your questions about COVID. Let's go to Jamie in Algoma. Jamie, hi, what is your situation?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I am immunocompromised. I was vaccinated, and I did have an antibody test showing that I'm not making antibodies, which may or may not mean I'm protected. My next-door neighbor has not been vaccinated, but she and I like to chat over the backyard fence. Should I be wearing a mask outdoors when I'm chatting with my neighbor?
That's a good question. So, one, there are different antibody tests that people do after vaccination. So I don't know if you talk to your doctor specifically. Most of the commercially available antibody tests are looking for the N protein, which is an antibody that would be produced from natural infection, but not from the vaccination. And so if you didn't have a specific antibody looking for the spike protein, that may or may not be an actual indication of whether you responded. But there's also other, parts of your immune system. There's T cell immunity, et cetera, that we can get from vaccination. So we still think or would hope that you are somewhat protected from the vaccine. But I agree with your neighbor. I mean, outdoors is going to be safe if you're over the fence and can be that, at least 3 to 6 feet apart. I think you are going to be more protected. But, I'd continue to talk to that person and make her aware, because you're immune compromised, you may be a little bit more vulnerable. And if it makes you feel comfortable to wear a mask, I absolutely think that is something you should do. But also, more importantly, her is an unvaccinated one, I think it'd be more important that she actually wear a mask to help protect you. Again, outdoors is going to be safer. And I think if you are spread enough apart, that may not be quite as important. But those are things you can continue to talk about with your friend and neighbor to really to help protect you.
Yeah, Jamie, thank you for the call. Joe now in Eau Claire. Joe, hi.
Hey, how's it going this morning?
Doing well. What is your question?
I have more of a comment. So the media lately has been using the term breakthrough infection, and that's kind of irresponsible in that, the vaccines weren't really created or tested to stop infection. They were, created to, stop serious illness and hospitalization. And by using the term breakthrough, it kind of implies that they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And I think that is, leading to more vaccine hesitancy.
Dr. Schwartz, what is your insight there on the terminology around breakthrough?
I actually 100% agree with Joe. When we say breakthrough, it sort of gives this impression that there was some sort of failure. But again, as I mentioned earlier, no vaccine is felt to be 100% effective. And when we looked at the original data from the mRNA vaccines, they were felt to be, you know, 94, 95% effective. Some of the early studies against the Delta variant suggest that they're somewhere in the 80s, but still excellent protection. And again, when we go back to, as Joe mentioned, the reduction in the risk for severe disease, hospitalization, death, truly that is our goal here, right? Of course, we don't want people to become infected, but more importantly, we don't want people to end up in the hospital. We don't want them to die. And so it's hard because everyone sort of latched on to this breakthrough terminology, but really I do have to agree with Joe. I don't want that to be associated with a negative connotation. The vaccines still work. They're still doing what they're going to do. But as we see, you know, a more infectious variant that's spreading very rapidly and the numbers increasing, of course, we are going to see more cases, even those individuals who have been vaccinated.
Dr. Schwartz, thank you for joining us.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks, Kate. Have a great day.
You too. Allison Schwartz, Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health Wisconsin Region. And for disclosure, SSM Health is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we talk with a nonprofit leader who argues in favor of Wisconsin's wine industry. That's after a news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are leaders in cheese and beer, but grape growers and winemakers, they haven't been able to break through and attract national and international acclaim. Also, where's the data? The last USDA wine industry survey for Wisconsin was published in 2015. Do you buy and enjoy Wisconsin wines? How do they compare to California varieties? What's holding back the industry here? It's 800-642-1234. Kathleen Gallagher is Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. That's a nonprofit that aims to grow the Great Lakes region's high-tech economy and culture. She wrote about the wine industry in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Kathleen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate.
Well, what is the stature of Wisconsin wines on the national and international scene?
Wisconsin wines aren't real prominent on that scene. There are no Wisconsin wines on Wine Spectator's most recent top 100 list, on Wine Magazine's most recent top 200, or among the prestigious Decanter Awards. So not real high profile.
Yeah, so we're not really showing up. Why aren't Wisconsin wines getting any type of recognition? What's going on?
Well, in the spirit of full disclosure, I'm no wine expert, more a business person. But what I've heard anecdotally is that Wisconsin wines tend to be fruitier and not the quality of, say, Napa Valley's wines or the wines that come out of France.
Okay, so we're fruitier here, not the quality of Napa. What sets us apart from Napa Valley?
Well, climate change has been devastating Napa Valley. So the wildfires and drought have ruined a lot of grape crops. California, they do this grape crush report, and they processed fewer wine grapes in 2020 than in any year since 2006. And there are all these stories coming out of there, you know, grape growers putting sunscreen on their grapes because of the extreme heat, using toilet water, recycling toilet water because of the drought, because their reservoirs are dry. So just all kinds of problems in Napa Valley and in other traditional wine growing regions of the world, like France and Italy.
What has the pandemic done? I mean, we'll get more into climate change, but has the pandemic had an impact on the industry?
Not that I am aware of.
Okay.
Found anything like that, but the devastation from changing temperatures and that sort of thing. You know, in France and Italy this year, there was a real warm March. The grapes started growing well. And then in April, there was a big freeze and it just knocked out a lot of the grapes, the wine grapes this year. So
What is our climate like here in Wisconsin? Is it, could it prove to be better for grape growing?
Well, it's as good. We're on the magical, 45th latitude, and all of the best grape growing regions of the world are between the 30th and 50th parallels. So Wisconsin, we're there. And then, you know, the point I was making in this column in the Journal Sentinel is that Door County and Michigan's Leelanau Peninsula are both coastal. And what you want is to be around that latitude and beyond the coast where it ensures warm days and cool nights. That's what's best for the grapes.
How has grape growing been in Door County in particular? Is it taking off?
I think there are a lot of wineries, like we talked about at the beginning of this conversation. They aren't making world-class wines right now. But I guess the argument I'm making is that they could, given the right circumstances.
So given the right circumstances, how could they improve the wine here in Wisconsin?
The information age, right? That's a funny start of the answer, but what the information requires is using what the information age requires is using information well and cooperation. So the argument I'm making is that the Wisconsin and Michigan wine grape growing organizations should band together and facilitate cooperation between the growers. And what's neat is you can use these new tools in the field of data science to cooperate. If you're with me, this is a little complicated, but kind of a fun idea. Want to keep going?
Yeah, let's keep going. How could you facilitate this cooperation?
Well, I personally think it would be the trade organizations, but I'm sure there are other organizations that can do it. But the idea would be all these wine growers, the good ones are keeping track of a lot of variables to begin with, right? They're looking at temperatures, they've got sensors out there. They're looking at temperatures, the amount of water in their wine, all the variables that you would think of involved in growing grapes and in producing wine. So what they could do is combine all that data. Everyone has their own data, and every year they try and get a little bit better using their data. But if they would combine all the data, they would have the ability to look at how everyone was affected, say by temperature or rainfall or that sort of thing, and really get to some good places. For example, they could maybe figure out that, this is what happened overall. I could use less fertilizer next year and still produce good grapes. So, and in terms of producing the wine, you set what they call the golden batch. What's the best year, the best wine you had, and what were the variables that year, and how can you work toward that in subsequent years?
Yeah, and so what I'm hearing is a lot more collaboration, a lot more transparency, and working together to get that golden batch, if you will.
Yeah, and using modern tools. And I think some growers are hesitant to do that because they're worried that if they provide, what would happen is they would provide their own information and everyone else would provide their own information. And then they'd be able to look at theirs and the rest of it would be anonymized. And I think they worry, California wine growers could get that information and use it. I'm not sure that's a big concern for two reasons. One, this big companies do this all the time, put their stuff in the cloud and use data analytics to analyze it. But also, we're in a different geography, different soils, et cetera. So I'm not sure that information would be that helpful to growers in other parts of the world anyway.
We're talking with Kathleen Gallagher, who is executive director of the Five Lakes Institute. She's sharing ideas on how Wisconsin's wine industry can grow, can compete. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Is there a winery in your area? What does it add to your community? Do you work in the wine industry or the beverage industry? What kind of boost do you think is needed? What type of data can you not get your hands on? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kathleen, why is it worth investing in a slowing market? Why should we really focus on amping up, if you will, our wine industry in Wisconsin?
Well, the market is slowing a little bit because baby boomers are aging. They're still buying wine at all price points, but they're not buying as much of it. Millennials aren't as interested in pure wine as baby boomers. They're interested in, well, you see this when you go to the grocery store or the liquor store, right? They're interested in craft beverages, in White Claw type drinks, you know, mixes of wine and other things. So one of my ideas in this column in the Journal Sentinel was, could someone develop a wine-infused version of the old-fashioned cocktail?
You know, I mean, you just you put the challenge out there. You never know. Let's take a call now. Erin in Madison. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind about the wine industry?
I just wanted to share a perspective. I work in the horticulture industry, and I had the privilege under being educated under some really brilliant people at the University of Madison for fruit crop production. And growing wine in Wisconsin is really difficult because wine, grape varieties in general, are grafted. So there's the rootstock that grows underground, and then there's the scion that grows above ground. And what we're trying to do in Wisconsin is develop more cold hardy varieties of the rootstock so that they are more adaptable to our Wisconsin climate. And then the rootstock, and then the scion is going to be a variety of grape that tastes delicious. But to do that takes a lot of time and a lot of research to be able to make these grafted varieties work in our region. And then some other things to take into consideration is, from a horticultural perspective, is successfully growing grapes starts with planning and site preparation, and then also understanding a lot about plant physiology and how everything that you're growing is interconnected, and being able to understand what is happening in the plants and why it's happening and how to produce the best quality grapes.
Erin, this adds so much. I'm wondering, where is Wisconsin at in the process of doing all this grafting of the varieties?
I know researchers at the university, especially at Madison, probably at Michigan, like you mentioned as well, are working pretty extensively to develop these new varieties. And I know there is, like, Wollersheim Winery and the Baraboo region is using some of those varieties now. So there are places that are using some of these newer technologies and research developments to produce better quality wines in the region.
Yeah, Erin, thank you. Kathleen, you know, as Erin says there, you know, finding those cold, hard varieties and grafting is really where the industry should be focused on.
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts. That was awesome, all the information Erin provided. One thought is, you know, when you're I think when you're talking about, you know, there's Door County and the Leelanau Peninsula, which are a little different because they're coastal, and then the rest of Wisconsin and Michigan. So just to make that clear, it's Michigan State in Michigan, which is kind of the agricultural focus school. So it seems like a really great idea if Erin's group and the people at Michigan State work together to develop some more of these varieties. But the other point I wanted to make is, you know, we're so blessed to have University of Wisconsin, UW-Madison here, and not only from a horticultural perspective, but their computer science school, the School of Computer Data and Information Sciences, is one of the top schools in the country for data. So if you can combine that horticultural expertise and the data expertise in that computer science area, you've really got something special that could make us very globally competitive. And then combine that with Michigan, and wow.
Kathleen Gallagher, she leads a nonprofit in Milwaukee helping high-growth businesses succeed in the Midwest. We're looking specifically at the wine industry. Do you work in the beverage industry? What kind of boost do you think is needed? Is there a winery in your area? How is it done in the pandemic? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kathleen Gallagher here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing Wisconsin's wine industry here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Climate change may lead to more opportunities for Wisconsin winemakers, especially as wildfires and drought ravage California. But is there enough wine culture in Wisconsin with technology to become a dominant player in the industry? It's 800-642-1234. Kathleen Gallagher leads Five Lakes Institute. She's been studying the potential of the wine industry here. And Kathleen is with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Max now in Kenosha. Hi, Max. What is your perspective on the industry?
Hi, Kate. So I think that Wisconsin is going to have a really hard time, you know, getting quite big in the wine industry, just because you already touched on it. The climate is just too cold. If you think about the really popular wine varietals that are sold in the United States, if you think of Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, all of those big varietals, all of those are vinifera grapes, and it's just too cold. And the growing season in Wisconsin is too short to grow those to their, you know, full potential. Most harvests happen, you know, for those varietals around late September, early October, and sometimes you already get snow in early October in northern Wisconsin. The lake can have a good effect because it is a, you know, warming. It has a warming effect on the grapes. That's why you see some Riesling, some pretty high quality Riesling being grown in Michigan. But unfortunately, in Wisconsin, it's just too cold for any sort of high quality grapes being grown. That's why when if you go to Door County, you'll see that a lot of the red wines that are made with decent quality grapes, all the grapes are imported from California. They're not grown locally.
Max, and you lived in France for a number of years. You're from France. Do you see a lot of difference in how grapes are grown in France versus how they're grown here in the U.S.?
I would say that a lot of the methods used in Washington and California and even like upstate New York are going to be very similar to the ones used in France. Technology, I think, in the United States is really evolved because American winemakers are more open to accepting new technology. But I think they're very, very similar.
Okay, very similar. Max, thank you for that perspective. Kathleen, you know, Max saying they're reiterating that climate is holding us back here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I from what I surmised, I would say that for the rest of the state, but I think Door County is special, like the Leelanau Peninsula in Michigan. So, you know, I think what we've kind of surfaced during this conversation is there are lots of efforts being made around the rest of the state by the horticulture people at UW to work on new grapes. But the coast, the bay side of Door County and the Leelanau Peninsula in Michigan, I think are special because they have that more temperate lake climate. That's what the person I talked to was someone at Michigan State, which is, you know, kind of the agriculture school in Michigan. So I'm sure Max is right about the rest of the state, but I think those two areas are special.
Those two microclimates. Bernard called from Madison, couldn't stay with us. Bernard is a professor at UW-Madison, says it would be worth creating a viticulture department here like they do in Napa Valley to teach about wine. What are your thoughts on that, Kathleen?
Well, I want to come back to this data piece. I just think it's this data analytics is so important, and that's where I'd start. You know, just to give perspective, there are all these big consultants, McKinsey being one of them, that used to go around and, you know, they'd come to you, they'd say, give us all your data and we'll figure out what you should do. And then they'd look at the data from everyone else. And what you can do now way more cheaply is cooperate and share your data. And, you know, I think that's the place to start. Like, let's figure out what we have. I really think it's on these wine trade associations in Wisconsin and Michigan to get that going. And then we can figure out if we need a viticulture department, but we got to figure out what we've got. And there are modern tools to do it if we could get somebody to embrace them.
We're talking with Kathleen Gallagher, who leads the Five Lakes Institute. She's sharing ideas on how Wisconsin's wine industry can use data to grow. You can join in with what you see. Do you buy and enjoy Wisconsin wines? How do they compare to California? Is there a winery in your area? What is it doing? Is it sharing its data? 800-642-1234. Kathleen, can you give some examples of other industries that aggregate and share data and that it's helping?
Huh, that's a trick question. You know, I didn't research that for the column, but I will say I wouldn't be surprised if some of the California wine growers are doing it. I think on the coast, there's more of an effort to do this. And the Midwest has been slower to embrace these new data analytics tools. So maybe there's a caller who
has some. What resources would it take to gather data from the wine industry? You know, how big of an undertaking is this?
Well, if you had a group that was really dedicated to it and you had the right experts involved, what you've got to do is build models. You know, what's the golden batch? What's the best wine you can aspire to? What are the best climate conditions? A consultant I talked to who does industrial stuff mostly said it would only take a couple months. You have to have a few months, maybe more than two. You have to have somebody spearheading the project. So maybe rather than a viticulture department at UW-Madison, the place to start is some researcher who wants to help the growers aggregate this data and apply data analytics to it.
Do you have any sense in what appetite that producers have in working together or their level of collaboration at this point in Wisconsin?
I don't. You know, one of the things I intended to do when I wrote this column was to call the trade groups for the wine producers, and I didn't. I got, you know how that is, got sent down a different path, but it would be interesting to me to figure out what the trade organizations are doing in each state and how they're approaching this new data analytics landscape.
And especially as we see our changing climate here in Wisconsin, it getting warmer. And, you know, as we've been hearing, we're just too cold here in Wisconsin. We have to graft more. But our climate is changing.
Right. And, you know, you can't underestimate the more temperate climate you get near coastlines as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably one of the reasons Michigan has, you know, made more progress because they've got a bigger lake coastline, right? They're on the east side of it.
Yeah.
That under county.
Well, Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Really fun to talk about.
Yeah. Kathleen Gallagher is Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute, a Milwaukee area nonprofit. Just ahead, the second in our new series, Ask a Contractor. We talk with a Madison Plumbing Service Coordinator about what you need to do to keep your home's plumbing running smoothly and what to do when something goes wrong. Have you had a plumbing issue in the pandemic? Did you fix it or did the plumber? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.